Good morning. So this morning I'd like to talk a little bit about choice. I think it was about maybe 5-10 years ago I read about some kids who were Mexican soccer players who came to the United States and rode the train up and were amazed when they got to go in the dining car and they saw they could have leche, milk, which they never got. They could have chocolate milk. They could have milkshakes. And they were just amazed. They all wanted to move to the United States immediately, being teenage boys and this array of choices that we have in the United States. And of course, our country was founded on principles of freedom of choice. And that's a core value in our culture. Freedom of religion, freedom of thought, freedom of the press, freedom of choice. And we try to maintain those values, most of us, politically, morally, socially, religiously. The Puritans came over because they could practice their own religion. They didn't have to conform. They had freedom of choice, freedom of religion. So we have this great tradition. And then we have the 21st century manifesting that tradition. Here in the Twin Cities, what do we have? We have, is it 4 or 5 Zen centers to choose from? Is it 3 or 4 Tibetan centers, Tibetan Buddhist centers to choose from? Maybe only 2 Vipassana centers? For how many people? We have certainly an array of choice, and that's quite wonderful because we can gravitate to what we resonate with, to what seems more authentic to us personally. On the one hand, right? On the other hand, I read an article in The Week magazine last week, which is an excerpt from the Atlantic Monthly that says, Americans' choice now is exhibited particularly in multitasking. Google, instant messaging, iPods, cable TV, etc., etc. So, and the study, they studied people who had been doing this a lot, flipping channels or doing text messaging a lot, and they compared them with a control group who hadn't been doing this stuff, and the level of stress related to hormones, was really high in this group. And their system seemed to be worn down, and they seemed to be prematurely aging. So much for multitasking, huh? Which is what? An array of choices instantaneously, all happening at the same time, which you can juggle to a point. So that's sort of how extreme that we've gotten in our culture. And I think we all need to pay attention to that. And of course, Zen is partly about staying within choices we make, staying within a choice that we make, and not immediately wandering to another choice. And we're reading Each Moment is the Universe in Practice Period, with the help of Andrew Martin and Katagiri Roshi. A lot of help from Katagiri Roshi and quite a bit of help from Andrea. And he talks about ornaments, decorations, and how we have decorations in our lives. He doesn't mention choice, but he mentions control as a decoration. He mentions expectation as a decoration, and clinging to meaning as a decoration. So choice very much can be that. It can be a way of getting sort of away from this reality right here, because maybe it's a little painful, because maybe it's a little boring, because we're looking for something else, and it's a way of doing that. So I don't know how many emails you guys get every day, but I'm amazed. And it's what's going to be like the next 10 years. What are we going to be doing as human beings? So Katagiri, when he talks about Katagiri Roshi, about ornaments and decorations, he says, sure, cultural creates those. We create all of these. But, good morning, come on in. But through Zen practice, we have the opportunity to face reality as it is. And so we have the phrase that I put in the program today from Sungsan. There is nothing difficult about the way, but avoid choosing. And we've been reading another Chinese Zen teacher in our morning study group, Hangzhi. And Hangzhi talks about the pregnant oyster. And someone asked, well, what does that mean? Someone asked, what does that mean, the pregnant oyster? Well, in Zen, the piece of sand that gets inside the oyster is considered an opportunity. An opportunity for what? An opportunity just to be with it, completely with it, until it transforms itself into a pearl. So that's the pregnant oyster in Chinese Zen. So there's nothing difficult about the way, but avoid choosing. You get a piece of sand, there it is. That's not so easy for us as human beings. Not so easy for us. But it's true that if we stay with that grain of sand, something will happen. Our life will settle down. Our mind will settle down. So I've told this story before about 8 or 9 years ago going to Guatemala with a service club to work with Mayan Indians who've been displaced from the war, from the genocide. War is not genocide is a better term. The genocide that had taken place in Guatemala, how they had fled into Mexico and then they were coming back. So a service club of guys and women went down there. And I was really involved in organizing it. But I got, as my roommate, someone I did not choose. And I knew that this was not what I wanted. When on the plane down, he was sitting in a row in front of me, and he was reading a book on how we could have won the war, the Vietnam War. And I already had issues with this guy, but here we were going down to help these indigent people in Guatemala, and he's reading a book on how we could have won the Vietnam War. And then I found out, oh, he was in the Air Force, he was in Vietnam. I thought, oh my God. And he's going to be my roommate, and we just have this one little room, you know, with a toilet there on the edge, because this was in the hinterland of Guatemala. So there I am. Well, this seems like a cliche, and because I say it so often, but there's my opportunity for practice. There's my opportunity for practice. That's not the piece of sand I asked for, but there it is. And so when this happens to us, usually we feel dissatisfaction big time, right? first mark of existence, dissatisfaction. I was actually instrumental in organizing this Guatemalan trip. I thought only kindred spirits would come down. People who had the same enlightened view of that I did, of helping people who've been disenfranchised. And there I was. There I was. The first mark of existence. Not getting what I want. Getting what I don't want. Simple. Simple. And actually, I had no choice to get out of it because I was one of the organizers of the trip. And I didn't find out. And they were all couples except me and him anyway. And I sure didn't want to be a couple with this guy. So there I am. We're on the plane. We're going down. And I know I'm just going to have to breathe. I'm going to try to do my zazen. I'm going to remember that this is an opportunity just to be here and see what happens. Well, so during the course of the trip, I begin to see some different things about him. I begin to see that he actually is going down because he's good heart. He has a good heart. And we begin to connect on a few things, like he takes pictures. He wants to take pictures of everyone. He's a good photographer. And he does them very sensitively. We just don't talk about the books he's reading. Every time I see them, I want to go the other way because I feel so strongly about this, as I do about the Iraq War, so strongly. I don't see how human beings could be doing this. I don't understand. And if they are doing it, then I really don't want to be around them, the ones who are promoting. But we are all in this world together as human beings, and we all are interdependent, and so here's a chance. So it went pretty well, and by the end of the trip, I got to be friends with this guy, he was kind of uptight among the native people. I think he thought they reminded him of the Viet Cong or something, you know, but he was taking pictures all the time, and he wanted to help, and he kept donating money, and so by the end, he'd softened, and I'd softened toward him. I mean, he did not become my best friend. Unfortunately, I'm still have my political limitations, but I have a few friends. Well, you know, we get defined by these things. They rein us in. They rein our relationships in, and we need to be able to see them, and honestly, just pay attention to them and see that they usually come from our own fear. They usually come from our own fear. this story has a pretty good ending because then this guy joined my nonprofit board of directors, where I work, and he became a donor and a friend. Well, he's not my best friend, but and I don't talk politics. We don't talk politics. Occasionally we do, but then the conversation ends. We have not talked about the Iraq War. We could talk about it, but we both feel so strongly that there's not much point in our talking about it. We could debate each other. There's just not much point. So, there is nothing difficult about the way, but avoid choosing. And Zen is a monastic discipline. We don't have a monastery here, exactly, but it's a monastic discipline. So, it's about moan. About being one, mono, one with your activity, one with your piece of sand, or with your pearl, whatever. So we try to do our best here. We have retreats where choice is kept to a minimum. We keep choosing to a minimum in our retreats because we want to be able to focus. And when we choose too much, when we're involved in a lot of alternatives, our monkey mind gets out of control. But if we just have one activity and another activity and another activity, it's a little easier on monkey mind. Monkey mind hates it at first, but after monkey mind begins to get in the groove, it's a little easier. So we have at this time of year, we have our traditional retreats. We're going to have a half-day one in November and then 7-day one in December, and you can only you don't have to come for 7 days. You can come for less days. And those are very precise in the way we comport ourselves, in the way we walk, in the way we sit, in the way we eat. That's very particular, very meticulous. Well, there's a reason for that. And the reason is that it helps the mind just be with what is. Just be with what is without having to make choices. Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do the other? And at first, the mind may feel trapped, like I felt trapped with BP. But this is the chance for to let the sand begin to transform into the pearl. And that's our practice and our life. Katagiri Roshi calls this touching the core of life. And we also do things here that many of you know, because many of you are involved in it, called practice periods. And we have one going on right now. We actually have 25 people in this practice period, which is wonderful. But it's the closest we can do to monastic life because we're here in the city. And practice period, people don't choose, supposedly. They fill out a commitment sheet at the beginning. They're going to commit themselves to so much sitting. They're going to commit themselves to doing a retreat. They commit themselves. So then they can just don't have to think about it. They can just show up and do the activity as in a traditional monastic setting. And that helps the mind settle down. Now, it's not easy because of all of we're bombarded by all those stimuli outside. But I don't think this practice has ever been easy, even in a monastic situation. Monastics had to worry about things like where were they going to get their next meal? What were they going to do with their hunger? What were they going to do with their poor nutrition and the diseases they got from that? We don't have to deal with that stuff. So we have different issues. So Rosemary Taylor is co-leading practice period with me. And before it started, we looked at the commitment sheet that people fill out. And I said to Rosemary, well, you know, we've done this every year for maybe 4 or 5 years now. But I know that I know what people will sign up for, and then I know what they're really going to do, just based on experience. And I said, I said to Rosemary, you know, they're not going to come to work day. A few of them will come, but it's been roughly 50%. They sign up, and maybe 30 to 50% come. So Rosemary said to herself, I'll fix that. She didn't tell me that, but then the first night she showed up as the co-leader. She gave a little talk about work. It was the best talk I'd ever heard about work in Zen. I got inspired. And then she said, if they couldn't make work day, they could do all these individual assignments. So we'll see. We have work day next Saturday. We'll see what happens, right? So in our book this last week, we were reading about Dogen. Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, and him going to China and meeting the Tenzo in China, the head of the kitchen, and that the Tenzo was working when everybody else was doing meditation. Just working in the kitchen, just taking care of things, just making things feel good. And Dogen said to him, why are you doing this when you could be emptying your mind in zazen? Isn't this why are you doing this? And there's the story about him having several encounters with his Tenzo. Dogen himself had probably not done that much manual labor before he came to China. We don't know exactly, but he came from an aristocratic family. But this Tenzo had a huge impact on him. And there's the story that I've told several times about him seeing the Tenzo out drying mushrooms in the midday sun and going out there and saying to the Tenzo, here you are drying mushrooms in this hot sun. Why are you doing that at a time like this? And the Tenzo is saying, what other time is there than this? So no choosing, something to be done, just doing it. And that changes Dogen's attitude, that so that he begins to stop doing things in order to do something else. Stops thinking of Zazen as something that you do in order to do something else, in order to get somewhere. And he begins to appreciate work. And so when he comes back, he actually makes the Tenzo, the number one guy in monastic life, because he sees how important it is, and he's able to let go of his ornament of trying to think that we do meditation to get somewhere, and the expectation that goes around along with that ornament, and the meaning that we project when we do that kind of ornamentation, which is not bad, which is wonderful, because it's human culture. So manual labor is really important in Zen traditions, starting with Baijiang, and then Dogen picks up on it. It takes him starts practice when he's 15, takes him 12 years to pick up on it. By the time he's 27, he begins to see how important it is. Without choosing, just doing whatever manual labor there is, because manual labor can be very meditative. Whether you're at home or whether you're here, manual labor can be rhythmic. You can get your body into it. You don't have to think. You can breathe with it. It can be very therapeutic and very calming. Last week I came. I didn't go to the talk here, and then I came for a meeting afterwards. And in the backyard, I saw two women raking leaves. And the backyard here has been looking really well cared for lately. Like people care about it. Like people care about each other. You know how you walk into a place sometimes and you just feel the care that everybody has about the place and each other? That's the attitude. That helps us just be with each other and support each other in a meditative kind of way. So at Tassajara Zen Monastery in California, the head monk's job is to clean the latrines. And this again goes way, 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 way back to China. Then they took a break in Japan, but then Dogen picked it up again after he got to be a little more mature. And when I was young, I didn't have a good attitude toward manual labor either. I always my sister and I tried to run away when my dad would have us do stuff or come up with excuses. But my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, really just worked with us a lot. We always swept after we did our meditation and became an extension of our work. So I got to see how good it was at helping you come back, helping me come back to just being here, whether it's a broom or a knife or taking care of it, treating it well, and creating a beautiful environment. Jeez, what could be more spiritual than that? And then work also. Work also is an opportunity just to give an offering, whether it's manual work or whatever it is. have to remind myself of this sometimes, but it's an opportunity to offer. If the work is ethical, it shouldn't matter what kind of work it is. Maybe you don't get to do manual labor. Maybe you have to, people get to rake out there and you have to stay up and work on your computer or your talk while everybody's raking out there. I always used to rake. Now I'm always up working on my talk. But next Saturday I get to rake because my health is good. And well, of course I will be giving a talk Sunday. But I do want to work outside. But whatever work you do, if we're focusing on not choosing but just being bare attention with what is, we just do it. And Bai Jiang, the head of the early Zen monasteries, who is famous for a day without work is a day without eating, he had a number of interchanges with his monks about work. And here's an interchange. Once Yunyuan asked Bai Jiang, "Every day there's hard work to do. Who do you do it for?" Bai Jiang said, "There is someone who requires it." Yunyuan said, "Why not have him do it himself?" Bai Jiang said, "He has no tools. He has no tools." So there's someone, there's some being who requires us to work, to share our lives. But she has no tools. We, our work, our effort, are her tools. Without us, she can't express herself. So whatever we have, if it's ethical, it's a chance to do something with some energy and some joy that comes from that one who requires it. Well, we never know her. We never know him. If we know him, then we make him into an object, right? But still, she requires it. And we can feel something good when we just do it. And then we may get a recognition, and that's great. We may get monetary reward, that's great. But that's not basically why we do it. And this is true in many, many spiritual traditions. Some spiritual traditions, work is in order to get something else. But in many traditions, in many monastic traditions in the East and the West, it's the work itself that is the acknowledgement and the love of interdependence, just manifesting itself. So, as many of you know, I spent time with Native Americans and doing things like going up on the hill where you do fasting and praying and doing late night healing ceremonies. And the time that I went up on the hill, they call that the hills in North Dakota. Not very high, but high enough. Up on the hill, you come back after being up there for a day or 2 days or 3 days meditating, praying, and you haven't eaten the whole time. And then they bring you down and they give you a little bit of food and a lot of water. And then you make a meal for the whole community. That's it. And everybody in the community shows up. And it's one way of feeding really poor people in the community, because the person who's been doing the fasting, been doing the praying, gotten the healing, if it's been a late night healing ceremony, always makes a huge meal. So there's no choice about that. If there was a choice about that, I sure wouldn't do it. After doing 5 days of sesshin but not getting to eat much during that sesshin, then you have to go make a meal for everybody. But it felt so good. I went down there. They did feed me enough so I wasn't really hungry. And then all these people helped me make my meal. And then all these people showed up. And it felt so wonderful. So wonderful. And we see that in many, many spiritual traditions. But this is not dualistic work. This is the work as the expression of she who requires it. But we don't know who she is. We don't need to know. We don't need to poke our head into that. If you poke your head into that, you won't just do it. But you can feel it. You can feel it. So, but on the other hand, let's not get fixated on this freedom from choice. Freedom from choice gives us a base, helps us return to radically accepting wherever we are, radically being there. If it's sand in the oyster, if it's raking in the yard, just being here with it. And then when we exercise our choice, it's a little more grounded, it's a little more steady. Comes out of this situation right here rather than this situation right here. And so our choices can have a little more wisdom, a little more rootedness, and a little compassion too. So in this country we have an opportunity to do both freedom from choice and freedom of choice coming out of that. And that's basically what I want to say this morning. Questions, comments? Can you speak a little louder?
Yeah. The guy I was on before, who went to
Guatemala.
Thank you. And you mentioned you can't talk about Iraq war with him. Do you really know how he stands on Iraq war? Has he spoken about it? Do you know, or are you just assuming?
Well, that's a very good point. But actually, I have overheard him talking about the Iraq war at my service club. And when I hear him, I get real quiet. Now whether I should do that or not, I don't know. It's just my coping mechanism. I do. Yes, I do. More troops. More troops. Yes, it's a good point. Go ahead. Yes, that's right. That's right. Uh-huh. Not just to assume.
No, it's somebody in a box
right.
The book they're reading and
exactly.
Maybe we don't really know.
Exactly. Uh-huh. There was a libertarian on the radio the other day. Well, my nephew called me from Alabama and said, there's this fellow on the radio, I really want to support this politician, and when I heard about the politician, I thought, well, he's anti-abortion, he's anti-gay, he doesn't believe in income tax, he doesn't support education. I thought, God, I don't want to hear anything about this guy. But then my nephew called me, he said, but you know, he's totally against the Iraq war. He doesn't believe in that. And I had just overlooked that and just dissed him. So as I did BP, I only got to know BP because I had to. If I hadn't had to spend 6 hours on the plane with him and 6 days in the room, I would have just checked him in that compartment. So I think we always have to pay attention to this. I always have to pay attention to this. And sometimes we'll be disappointed. Sometimes our bare attention will just get more sand. But sometimes we'll see that sand actually converting into something else or not being sand at all. Thank you. Other people? Yeah.
So I was actually thinking a little bit about this idea of choice before. And what about the initial choice people make? That, like, when we were starting practice period or before practice period, people, maybe the first day, talk about how difficult practice
mm-hmm.
is.
Mm-hmm.
And then part of my reaction or response, I'll be nice about it myself, is, okay, here we are in practice period with this group of 25 people, and people have made the choice to put themselves mm-hmm. in the container.
Mm-hmm.
And so my reaction part of it is like, okay, you guys, you put yourself in this container. What are you grumbling about
mm-hmm.
in some way? But on the other hand, you know, kind of like, but people have to make the choice to say, this is what I want to do.
Of course.
And so,
of course.
Or like when you were doing your thing and going up to the hillside, you said, well, maybe I wouldn't have chosen to make this meal, but actually beforehand you probably knew at the end you would
of course.
Make the meal. So,
of course.
So it mm-hmm. all comes together, and there is some kind of choice being made.
That's right. That's right. Of course, it's circular. It's circular, and we have to start out. We have to start our practice with aspiration, and we have to not only start it. We have to always come back to aspiration. If we don't have an aspiration, our practice becomes dry. And our aspiration is a choice we make. I'm aspiring to this. I'm aspiring to follow this practice of. Being in bare attention without getting caught by choosing for this time. That's my aspiration. I have to come back when I see BP to my aspiration again. When I hear him talking to someone about the Iraq War and how we need more troops. How we didn't do it. We didn't do it in Vietnam. We lost. We could have done it. And so my aspiration is to be with him, acknowledge his humanness. And so I'm making a choice to do that. But then, no choice is when I just live out my aspiration to be there with him. So choice, no choice, no choice, choice.
And from what Phoebe was saying, too, and what you were saying with assuming, you know, you're talking about BP's thing on Iraq, but you're also talking really about his open-heartedness and his wanting to be in Guatemala and be involved.
That's
and
right.
Trying his best and
that's
giving
right.
money towards it.
That's
know.
Right.
So, you know, there's
yeah.
so many different parts
oh, sure.
of a person.
Oh, sure. That's right. That's right. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, because I'm an optimist.
Pardon?
I'm an optimist.
Okay.
Or whatever.
All right. Anything else this morning, guys? Any other questions or comments?
Show us your pearl when you're done with BP.
My pearl. Well, you know, that pearl is always in the making. It's always in the making.
And maybe you've never done with BP.
Pardon?
And maybe you're never done with BP.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe not. I mean, pardon? Uh-huh. Well, I mean, there's a little pearl right now. It's a little pearl. It's got some sand in it, but he's very helpful to my agency. I'm very respectful of many things he does. So there's a little pearl. And, you know, a lot of sand. But that's life, isn't it?
And if it's not BP, it'll be something else.
That's right. You got it. You got it, Phoebe. Yeah.
I just wanted to share one thing that ties in with the
sure.
sand a little bit. There was a Benedictine monk who's talked a lot about gratitude, and he said happiness is a necessary consequence of gratitude.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And that confused people, got everybody into, well, am I theistic, atheistic, gratitude for what?
Mm.
And that was a big question.
Mm.
For God, you know.
Yeah.
So he said, well, for opportunity.
Ah.
Oh, opportunity. Then the next question, opportunity of what? And they said, to participate. To participate. And isn't that the choice?
Uh-huh.
We
uh-huh.
have the choice to participate uh-huh. or not participate.
That's very good. Yeah, that's very good, Randy. Yeah. Yep.
I'm curious about when you have a choice between, if you had a choice to change roommates, if you have a choice to change jobs, or you the analogy of I have a thorn in my hand.
Yeah.
Do I take that as the opportunity to grow, or do I pull the thorn out?
Yeah. Yeah, that's why we have to be careful about this. This is not either or. This is not either or. Don't take away some sort of truism from this talk. This is paying attention to that thorn, really, really being aware of it, and then based on feeling it, based on noticing its breadth and depth, and breathing into it or breathing out of it, deciding what to do. Sometimes pull it out, and sometimes don't. I had two splinters in my... Where did I get those? So I was going barefoot someplace. I still do these things. I spent too much time in North Dakota going barefoot. So I was going barefoot a while ago someplace. Oh, I know where it was, yeah. I got splinters in my foot. And the first time I thought, well, I'll just let them go. I'll just, you know, be with them. And they'll work themselves out. I can still do my zazen. And there's a chance just to be with them, right? I didn't go. But then they start getting affected. So then I went to the doctor. The doctor pulled them out. He actually put me on an antibiotic. So in that case, I think I went a little too far, wouldn't you? I mean, the antibiotic was something unnecessary. I should have just gone to the doctor. Well, so then about a week later... my foot is inflamed, bottom of my foot is inflamed again, and it looks to me like there's still a little tiny piece in there left. So I immediately go to the doctor this time. He said, yes, there's a little piece left, so he pulls it right out. So we just don't know. This is about bare attention. This is about trying to take care of this life that's given to us. Trying to be aware, trying to be still, and trying to find the kindness just to sometimes choose things and sometimes let go and not choose. In service of she, whom we don't know anything about, but she's here. We're serving her, even though we don't know her.
I have a problem with that, she whom we don't know anything about.
Well, this is Pai Chang's phrase, and we can only speculate what he means by it, but I think he's talking about the inconceivable, which is right here, which is manifesting itself as all of us right now. We don't know anything about it, her, him, it, but here it is.
Can't we touch that?
We can't touch it. How can we touch it?
Well,
because then it's an object.
Uh-huh.
God, and that's what we do with that concept.
But I think it's more like Thich Nhat Hanh talks about changing our karma right now also changes our future as well as our past. What we do today, we don't know how it's going to affect somebody, you know. The Dalai Lama talks about our interconnectedness, that the person that planed this piece of wood did it with love, not knowing that it was going to be in a Zen center when they built this house on the shores of Lake Galilee. Mm-hmm. But the love that's in this piece of wood and the guy that grew it went out and chopped it down, and all that love that's in it comes up out of this because we're connected to it. They didn't know who they were going to affect. That's the inconceivable. What is it that you said at the retreat? I keep heavens. Inconceivable moments of heaven or something like that. That just, it brought back that, you know, one of the things that happened to me, that I got that return, you know, that paying it forward type thing where I went through something 20 years ago and today I saw the results of what I went through medically is on somebody else in a totally different form. It had grown, it had become something. And the leg that they saved on my body taught somebody and taught somebody and taught somebody and taught somebody so that this kid could have a leg today too. Mm-hmm. And that was like, whoa. I couldn't have, you know, when I'm
laying there in the emergency room going, we're going to learn something tonight. I didn't know how far reaching that was going to be. And that just, that's like my grain of sand that I get to carry with. So, I want to say, to connect with the pearls, because one of my favorite little Zen thoughts is one of the first things I read was about being a bag of pearls and a bag of skin.
Pearls and a bag of skin.
It refers to when the Zen monks are cremated, they go through the ashes, and usually what's left are these little, they call them pearls. And it's just, I don't know the whole scientific thing, but there was a Theravadan display of several Zen, not man, but Buddhist monks, their pearls, they had collected them from the ashes, and it was to build some big 16-foot Buddhist thing in Thailand, or 20-foot, I don't know, but they had one of those, it was a tour, and I thought about the pearls, because we don't know what is going to be a grain of sand, what is going to turn into a pearl. And then when our ashes are, when they can go through our ashes and they find the pearls. So.
Sure.
How do we know if doing her work is actually causing a disservice?
Gee, I don't think we know. I think we have to, you know, it come back to, does it feel connected? And is it ethical? And does it feel connected? And does it come out of stillness? If it comes out of stillness and it's ethical and it feels connected, it's almost always okay.
I mean, in terms of kind of denying her an opportunity to grow through the process of having to do the work herself.
No. In order to deny her...
The growth or the teaching of the work herself?
Oh, yeah. Well, so you're talking about... Yes, you're talking about this other issue, I think. Could you guys hear what she said? So I think she's talking about the issue of doing what the Tibetans call idiot compassion. I think you're talking about that. I'm not sure. Which is over-helping someone. Is that what you're talking about? Over-helping someone, being when they really need to do it themselves. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah, well, the Tibetans call that idiot compassion, and we just have to pay attention to it, especially if we're trying to fill ourselves up because we feel inadequate. That's a really good clue. If somehow... we have to do this for them to feel better about ourselves. If so, it's not coming from stillness. If so, it's coming from codependency, right? Mm-hmm. In some form or another. Don't you think? Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's long enough for today.